Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and reaction is coming into President Obama's State of the Union address. This morning, House Speaker John Boehner invited Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak before Congress next month in response to President Obama's threat to veto any additional sanctions on Iran. Netanyahu, a proponent of sanctions on Iran. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving will weigh in on that in a few minutes.
But first, further reaction. Among other things, the president called for tax reforms to lower the tax burden on lower and middle income earners while getting more revenue from the wealthy.
Middle class economics works. Expanding opportunity works. And these policies will continue to work as long as politics don't get in the way.
Let's bring in Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Senator, welcome back.
Hello, Robin. How are you doing?
Good. And first, your response overall to the speech.
Well, I certainly would have preferred listening to a president that was showing greater levels of cooperation. I know he says an awful lot of the right things about working with us and bipartisan, but just about every proposal that he offered, that he talked about, he knows it, you know, divides, you know, certainly America.
Well, and give some examples.
Well, I mean, his tax proposal, he got a $700 billion tax increase over 10 years in the fiscal cliff. Now he's coming back and just demanding more. Listen, we're all supportive of community colleges. He calls it free 2 years, but it's going to cost $60 billion. I certainly would have preferred hearing a whole lot more about, you know, what his plans are, how he's going to lead this nation to keep us safe and secure from ISIS, as opposed to, you know, just a couple sentences about it. So we have some significant issues facing this country, and I don't think he spent enough time in the State of the Union really discussing, you know, what our goal is, what our strategies are.
Well, take taxes, for an example. We know the president wants to lower taxes for the middle class, and to do that by closing, as he says, some of the loopholes on the wealthy and corporations. We've heard that there may be areas for compromise on this, that Republicans have felt that one of the reasons that corporations, for instance, put their money offshore is that there is such a high corporate tax rate. Isn't there room for compromise there? Maybe lower the tax rate, but require that companies keep their money here?
Well, I think if he's really talking about tax reform that makes America more competitive in the global economy, I think that's something Republicans would embrace, but that's not what he's really talking about. He's really talking about a tax system of a more further redistribution, where you're taking from one group, giving to another. And I mean, let's face it, the top 1%, depending on what study you're looking at, CBO versus IRS in 2012, pay somewhere between 35 and 38% of the income tax. I mean, we've got a progressive system already. What we need to do is we need a more competitive tax system, certainly in terms of business income.
Well, you and other Republicans are saying that you didn't feel a spirit of cooperation last night. There are analysts saying that this might have been the most they've heard the word veto in a State of the Union speech. Your colleagues in the House have bills to ban abortions after 20 weeks and accelerate building of natural gas pipelines. The president said he'd veto those. He'd veto attempts to undo his deportation delay or undercut Obamacare or lodge more sanctions against Iran. Your sense of that?
Well, we have a new Congress. And when you start a new relationship, this is the way I approach businesses. You try and find, first and foremost, the areas of agreement. Builds relationship, builds a level of trust, a whole lot easier finding common ground. President Obama started this relationship threatening and then enacting unilaterally immigration reforms, which many of us really asked him not to do because we knew it was going to make it that much more difficult for us to actually get true immigration reform through Congress. So that's where he started. He started out threatening vetoes before we even have a chance to introduce bills on the floor of the Senate, debate them, and pass them. So again, he hasn't, his words may be good in terms of cooperation, but his actions have been really quite divisive, I would say, at best.
Well, the president may have been buoyed last night by recent polls that show that, in fact, his approval ratings are going up, that people are feeling more positive because of many of his actions. Something like 80% of Americans in recent polls are. Do the Republicans run into danger of being the ones who seem to be provoking a president by going after what are some of his pet legislation?
Well, first of all, one of the reasons people's expectations on the economy are buoyed is because of low energy prices, which this president really had nothing to do with. His policies run contrary to that. I think the way we should proceed is, even with threats of veto, and this is exactly how I'll be conducting myself as chairman of the Committee on Homeland Security Government Affairs, is we'll look for those areas of agreement. You know, anything we pass in the Senate has to be done with bipartisan support. We are going to need at least 6 Democrat senators voting for any piece of legislation that will pass. So we share the same goal. I want to keep America safe and secure. I want to provide President Obama the authority for use of military force to defeat ISIS, his stated goal. The problem is he hasn't told us what that goal really means. He certainly hasn't laid out a strategy, and he certainly hasn't provided language for the authorization. Also want to work with him on cybersecurity. So there are a lot of areas of agreement. I wish he would have emphasized those, but that's what Republicans will emphasize moving forward, those areas of agreement that we can actually get the economy moving forward, provide a safer and more secure, a more prosperous America.
Senator Ron Johnson, the Republican of Wisconsin, reacting to last night's State of the Union. Senator Johnson, thank you.
Have a great day.
And joining us now with more is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Ron, he's talking about areas of agreement. What are they? What are the areas of agreement that you're expecting the president and the new Republican Congress are going to be able to work on coming off of the State of the Union address?
Right now, it looks like they would be highly limited. It looks like they can agree on some things having to do with trade. The president would like to get the Trans-Pacific Pact done, but he has a problem there with a lot of Democrats. So this may be one opportunity for him to work with the Republicans and tell the Democrats that they need to find some other leader for the moment. But apart from that, and apart perhaps from some corporate tax reform that the two sides might be able to agree on, the president seems to be marking out a confrontational strategy in general. And the Republicans, while they're a little bit stunned, perhaps, at the man they saw before them last night, the Republicans are ready to do their part in that confrontation to represent what they see as what the country voted for in November.
What do you mean stunned? Why were they stunned by what they saw last night?
Well, I don't think they were expecting him to congratulate them on what happened in November and taking over the Senate and gaining seats in the House. But they were looking forward perhaps to some acknowledgement that the world had changed a little bit for Barack Obama, because in their minds, it has changed. November was a great judgment from the voters. And so they didn't anticipate seeing an invigorated and aggressive president talking about what he sees as his successes, or at least the country's successes over the last 6 years, and giving this Congress his own marching orders.
Well, speaking of that, he came out and said that he would veto any attempt to slap new sanctions on Iran while the negotiations continue over the nuclear program. And just this morning, House Speaker John Boehner invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address Congress next month about the threat from Iran. Boehner was asked whether that was intended to poke the president in the eye for promising to veto any new sanctions that Congress might impose against Iran. Here's what Speaker Boehner said.
I don't believe I'm poking anyone in the eye. There is a serious threat that exists in the world. And the president last night kind of papered over it.
Ron, how do you see this playing out?
It depends on what comes up in the Iran deal, what gets worked out. Right now, the president has said himself, talking to the media, that he thinks the odds on a deal are less than 50-50. If Congress wants to weigh in at this point and show that they're standing ready to enforce the national skepticism about Iran and show solidarity with Israel, popular positions for certain, at least solidarity with this particular Israeli regime, and you mentioned Netanyahu, who's always been a great Republican favorite, and now that Republicans are running the full Congress, they surely will want to embrace him, and it really does come down to what's in the deal and whether or not the president and Secretary of State John Kerry can actually sell that and portray Iran as a reasonable partner. After all, they're helping with the fight against Islamic State, and there are a lot of shared interests. There could be some benefits out of such a deal. It will depend on what's in it and whether or not the president can do a selling job to the country as a whole.
What about the Keystone Pipeline? In the GOP response last night, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, just elected, called the pipeline the Keystone Jobs Bill. But here's what President Obama said about it last night.
21st century businesses need 21st century infrastructure. Modern ports and stronger bridges, faster trains, and the fastest internet. Democrats and Republicans used to agree on this. So let's set our sights higher than a single oil pipeline. Let's pass a bipartisan infrastructure plan that could create more than 30 times as many jobs per year and make this country stronger for decades to come.
Ron, where do you see this issue going?
The Keystone Pipeline will be approved, has been approved by the House a number of times, will probably be approved by the Senate despite an amendment process that's dragging out through the month. Then the president's going to veto it because of the process that the Congress has followed and because he does not feel his administration has signed off on it yet. And then the Senate will probably fail to override. The House will almost certainly fail to override, and we'll be right back where we are. And to be clear, the Keystone Jobs Bill is the Keystone Pipeline, and it would create jobs, many of them in the construction, which, of course, would be temporary jobs. And what the president's talking about is some kind of massive national program of building highways and bridges and so on, something more along the line of the interstate highway system built in the 50s. So these are really totally different kinds of projects, but the essential political difference is between having it be a government program, tax-supported, fee-supported, or being a program of creating jobs through something like an individual pipeline in the private sector.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Ron, and that is, I mentioned her a minute ago, Joni Ernst, the newly elected senator from Iowa, Republican. She gave the Republican response. Now, we remember in years past during the Obama presidency, there have been a lot of you wouldn't probably call them gaffes all the time, but Marco Rubio with his bottle of water and Bobby Jindal coming down the stairs, and people said it looked like an entrance from Gone with the Wind. How did you think Joni Ernst did?
She didn't make any real news of the kind that you described. There was certainly nothing negative in it. So I think she did herself some good. She did Republicans some good. And people will say nice things about her. We basically heard the stump speech that she gave in Iowa. And she doesn't like to take a lot of unscripted questions from reporters. So we'll see how she does with that as she gets more seasoning for the national stage.
Ron Elving, senior Washington editor for NPR News, talking with us about the State of the Union and the response. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The spat over the allegations of no-go zones in Europe continues. This week, Fox News apologized after several anchors, show hosts, and guests repeatedly cited evidence of what they said were Muslim-ruled enclaves where non-Muslims, like the police, were not allowed in. Yesterday, we spoke to the Lord Mayor of Birmingham, England, who said there was no such thing in his diverse city. And the Mayor of Paris is standing by her threat to sue Fox for claims of no-go zones in her city. But yesterday, France's Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, said there is a deep-rooted problem in his country. There are two Frances, and it's a country in a state of territorial, social, and ethnic apartheid. What exactly are these French suburbs, banlieues, that we're talking about? John Lester is a reporter with the Associated Press and former AP bureau chief in Paris. He recently went to Grand Bourne, the housing project where one of the Paris shooters, Amadi Coulibaly, grew up. John joins us from Paris. And John, you describe a pitiful, structurally isolating place. We'll get to that. But the Paris version of the Jon Stewart show was the first to reject this claim of no-goes?
The no-go zones have given us quite a few laughs here in Paris. One of the TV shows here, Le Petit Journal, has been absolutely merciless about this whole no-go controversy. Parts were supposedly meant to resemble Afghanistan or other places like that.
Well, so there's been a lot of fun made of this in France. But you describe a place so scary, as you write, that even police venture only with caution.
Well, outside of many of France's big cities, in the 60s and 70s, when France needed housing for workers that it was bringing in to basically work in its factories, it put up these big housing estates. And I visited one of these housing estates. Now, in the 1960s, when this place was built, it was considered something of a utopia. New buildings, children to be able to play in the parks. It sounded pretty great. Well, 40 years on, these places are looking very ragged. And the banlieue of Paris, the banlieue of French towns. These are the places that went up in flames in 2005 when we had riots here that lasted for something like 3 weeks.
Well, you say that since then and now, these housing projects look like giant social and architectural mistakes. You talked a little bit about the history, how this is a post-colonial effort. These were workers that were brought over to, as you write, provide muscle for France's post-war growth when so many men had been off to war. And now the people living there are sort of the descendants of these workers?
That's absolutely right. Now, the Grande Borne is the one that I visited. I went there because this is where Amédée Coulibaly grew up. His parents came from Mali.
You talk about how it was thought it would be sort of a utopia, parks for children to play. There were no streets to make it child-friendly, but that also made it difficult for police to police it.
Very difficult for the police to police. We spoke to policemen who actually work in this project. This is a very large project. We've got 11,000 people. The police were saying that essentially it's so tricky for them to get in there and so tricky for them to operate that whereas in other parts of Paris they can patrol quite happily in pairs or in threes, here they need 10 people to do those same jobs. Essentially, they need to watch out for each other. In this particular neighborhood, police have been attacked by Molotov cocktails, people with shotguns, stones. This is one of the first places where police were shot at during the 2005 riots that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. And in fact, when we were reporting there just last week, one of the mayor's assistants said, like, let's go and do some filming. So we followed out and followed him. And within seconds, teenagers with their heads covered with hoods started throwing stones and basically chased us away. And the mayor's assistant was saying, we've got to get back inside, got to get back inside. It's a tough place to live.
Well, but John, that also does sound like a no-go zone.
Well, the mayor himself and his assistant, again, was saying that doctors here don't make house calls. Now, that's, you know, if my kids are sick, I can call up a doctor and get somebody in here at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning. He said that basically that doesn't happen there. And same thing with parcels. If they want to get a parcel delivered, he said that they have to give an address that's outside of this housing project because basically the mail workers won't deliver parcels there. So
how do you square this reality that you're describing with the mocking of the sense that there is a no-go zone? As you said, France having a lot of fun with that.
I just don't want to get into the idea of the no-go zone. I just felt that it was just, you know, it's like any label. It doesn't really tell the story, does it? These are complex places. I mean, there are 11,000 people who do live there. The police are saying that essentially what we have is just a small number of delinquents, drug dealers, who are basically holding the place hostage, is pretty much the way they describe it. People do live there, but it's a place where the French state has, you know, doesn't have the same reach that it does over other parts of France.
And of course, we're well aware that here in the United States, there are failed housing projects and the thinking has changed on, you know, gathering impoverished people in one small area as well. So this is not new thinking. But the Prime Minister, Valls, is being criticized for using the word apartheid. After all, this is not state-imposed segregation. But as you said, there's history behind it. It's perhaps state-created in bringing these workers over after World War II. But what is the sense of what happens now? Obviously, the country is concerned about this.
Well, there were some very disturbing parallels that can be drawn with another shooting that we had in France in 2012. This was down in Toulouse, which is down in the south. This was a gunman who killed a rabbi, some children, and some soldiers. But these were three paratroopers and three Jewish schoolchildren. And he, too, had grown up in one of these tough housing projects. The mayor in the Grand Borne, this is the suburb south of Paris that I went to, he said something that really struck me. You will have heard, and I think everybody will have read and seen, the massive march that Paris had, you know, over 1 million people in the streets. And everybody was saying how that sort of showed a French spirit of fraternity. Well, you know, the motto of France is fraternity, equality, and liberty. And the mayor was saying, so we've seen fraternity in action, but he said in the neighborhood, the Grand Borne, that he is the mayor of, you don't see equality in action because obviously if people there can't call a doctor and if they can't get mail delivered and they're not living with the same safety as everybody else in France or in, you know, in better off places of France, then they're basically living in unequal lives. I mean, he was saying that it's a problem even for people who are trying to find work. I mean, the unemployment rate in this sort of poor enclave is 40%.
And by the way, we should also point out, though, that you found that many people do thrive and succeed having lived there. One of Koulibaly's sisters is making her name as a dancer, you write. Another classmate is in finance. People have succeeded.
People have succeeded, and the mayor himself is a good example. He grew up in this exact same housing project, went to the same school as Amedy Koulibaly. But he was saying that people from the neighborhood, when they write in for jobs, send in their CVs, just having the name the Grand Bonne on their CV can be enough to get them turned away. And I actually met somebody who complained that he had applied for 4 jobs and that basically had not got anywhere because when prospective employers read where he's from, they basically turn him away.
That's John Lester, the Associated Press in Paris, who actually went to one of the neighborhoods that's been under so much discussion, this idea of a no-go zone. John, thank you for giving us insight. Thank you.
My pleasure.
In his State of the Union address last night, President Obama renewed his pledge to close the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Since I've been president, we've worked responsibly to cut the population of Gitmo in half. Now it is time to finish the job, and I will not relent in my determination to shut it down. It is not who we are. It's time to close Gitmo.
The Obama administration is taking steps to close the prison by releasing inmates, but there are still more than 100 detainees being held there, as the BBC's Aleem Makbul reports.
They're living in a communal environment, which allows them to pray and eat with their brothers.
We were inside the most controversial prison in the world, first touring the cell block for Guantanamo's most well-behaved inmates. Well, I'm having to keep my voice down because we're at an observation point where guards monitor what detainees are doing through one-way glass, and on the other side of the glass I can see a communal area with several of the detainees either sitting, reading newspapers, there's one eating, another one is washing a dishcloth in a sink, wearing headphones, and another one was pacing up and down with prayer beads in his hand. The men we were watching had been at Guantanamo Bay for up to 13 years. Only a handful have ever been charged, and many of those we could see still languishing here were cleared for release years ago.
We control is the books, color uniforms, and recuperation time, and as well as our media time.
But we have to go to a different block to see where the last British resident detainee, Shaker Ahmed, is being held. It's a wing where prisoners have lost privileges, including their communal time, for not being cooperative.
I see every detainee, and I have never had an extended conversation with him.
All the detainees are hoping for that extended conversation with Colonel David Heath. He runs the detention facilities at Guantanamo, but he's also the man who breaks the news to prisoners they're being released.
I always like to see the reaction that I get from them when I go in and tell them that they're leaving, because they've been here for 12, 13 years. It's a long time for anyone. I guess I have mixed feelings about it, because I believe that at some time in their life they did something against me or my soldiers or my army or my country.
The point human rights groups have been making throughout Guantanamo's existence is if these men have done something wrong, then provide the evidence and put them on trial. But one problem is some of that evidence was gathered through duress, some here in Guantanamo, at parts of the camp that have now been closed. Well, Camp X-Ray was the part of Guantanamo Bay that became notoriously linked to some of the very heavy-handed tactics that were used here. Now, though, the place is overgrown. We can see the wooden shacks that were used for interviews in disrepair. We can see the cells with their barbed wire around them becoming rusty. But it remains because human rights lawyers want it one day to be used as evidence of what really happened to those brought here. Of course, the alternative to charging and trying prisoners or to just holding them is to release them, with a flurry of people being let out of Guantanamo over the last 6 weeks. But there are dozens of others who've already been cleared, still waiting their turn, and there is simply no movement forward on what to do with the men imprisoned here who are still deemed to be a threat, yet have never been tried. 13 years since its creation, Guantanamo still does not have the feel of a place in its final days.
The BBC's Alim Makbul in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
And it's summertime in Australia when bushfires are always a problem, but this season is the worst in more than 30 years. A farmer died battling a blaze last October. Thankfully, no humans have been reported killed in this month's fires, but many animals have been killed or badly injured. So after firefighters go through, it's the vet's turn. Dr. Rachel Westcott is a veterinarian with the South Australian Veterinary Emergency Management, or SAVEM. She's been responding to the terrible Adelaide Hills fire. Dr. Westcott, how does it work? Vets across the country just sign up with your group to be, what, on call?
That's pretty much it, Robin. We have vets who are volunteers and vet nurses who are volunteers, but we do insist that they go through our training program. We don't just put people untrained into a fire ground because it's an extremely dangerous place to be. So they volunteer with us, they start off with an introductory online training program, and then they come to our training workshops.
And then, as we said, they sign up to be called to respond when there is something like a fire or a disease outbreak. So then what do? Walk through the burn area?
Everything's a bit different. It's all a case-by-case basis. For this fire, because it's so large, it has a 220-kilometre fire perimeter, which is about 100 miles in your terms and about 30,000 acres. And the terrain is very steep. It's very inaccessible. We have not been able to walk through the fire ground because of the danger of falling trees. And what we have been doing is relying on members of the public to be our eyes and ears, and they ring in with animals needing assistance. So we send out then a response team, which is usually one or two vehicles comprising at least one vet, and we go and retrieve those animals from the fire ground, or sometimes we can even treat them on site.
Well, and they've also been going to the Adelaide Koala and Wildlife Hospital for treatment. We hear about burnt kangaroos, koala bears. What kinds of animals are we talking about?
Well, we respond to animals of all species. There are some primary producers in the area. So initially there were livestock, but there are also lots of pet livestock, horses, alpacas, small numbers of sheep, and some domestic pets as well. But now, and all the way through, but particularly now as animals are coming out of the fire ground, we're seeing koalas and kangaroos primarily, mm-hmm. and those animals have some pretty severe injuries. Some of those are also going to the Adelaide Zoo, and we're sending animals to some local private veterinarians as well. But mainly now they're quite severely, they're in need of intensive care, so they're going to the zoo.
Well, we want to hear more about them in a second, but you know, for those who are saying, oh, all of this effort for animals, it's easy to understand for people who are animal lovers, but we understand that this is also safer for humans because people are more likely to evacuate burn areas if they know that their domestic animals can be taken care of.
There's certainly a growing body of knowledge that supports that. But the human-animal bond is a very, very strong thing in our society, and people value their animals greatly. And there are many, many reasons why animals are valuable to human well-being. And yes, people are more likely to evacuate if they know their animals are going to be cared for, are going to be saved, are going to be treated, and they're going to see them again.
Now, I've read about other occasions where people wouldn't leave because they weren't allowed to bring a dog or a cat onto, say, a rescue vehicle. So there's that. And then there's the mittens. People may have heard of this. The terrible pictures of a koala with burnt paws, and the International Fund for Animal Welfare posted the pictures, sent out an appeal for mittens, and you were overwhelmed. I mean, in fact, I think I read a post that said, stop sending mittens, because so many people had sent them. And then the call was to make pouches for orphan kangaroos, because they needed to have almost this like sewn up diaper to be in if they were without their mothers. So tell us more about those two needs.
Sure. Yes, you're absolutely right. We are mittened out at the moment. We have mittens for the next couple of responses, I think. But that's lovely because we really value people being involved, and it's some people can't contribute in any other way, and we really value that as part of people's response to the animals' needs. Pouches, we're not doing too badly for pouches, but pouches are something that's perhaps a little overlooked, and pouches are very useful. Sometimes we have the need for quite little ones, for possums. Kangaroo Joey's, if the parent has died.
Kangaroo Joey? Is that the baby?
Yes, kangaroo joeys are their little babies, and they are viable as long as they're about 80 grams if the parent dies. So we need little lined soft pouches for them.
Well, we'll link people to how they might help. But meanwhile, the Australian Marine Wildlife Research and Rescue Organization posted a Facebook message saying, well, wait a minute, mittens for koalas might impede the animal's ability to hold leaves and branches. But your group took the position that mittens were needed to help the koala's paws heal after they were burned. You know, it really is a powerful reminder of how we do care about these animals. Is this unique to your country, or have other countries contacted you about this idea of organizing in advance these on-call veterinarians to respond to fires?
There are several groups around the world that are veterinary response groups. One that you will know in your country is the Veterinary Emergency Response Team from UC Davis, run by Dr. John Madigan. And Dr. John Madigan came here for a conference about 5 years ago, and I spoke with John then, and he had some very powerful messages to tell us. And we had already started SAVEM because of the 2009 Victorian bushfires, but it was a strong link for us linking into the veterinary community.
So in other words, you actually got advice from veterinarians in California who've had to fight so many fires there.
Well, we certainly looked at all the website, and I've been to some of John Madigan's talks, and we certainly had some early initial directions in which we needed to head came from there. And going right back to the Californian fires in the 1970s is where the incident command system stems from that we use here.
Well, a couple last questions about what you do. If you find a healthy animal in a burned out forest, do you leave it to fend on its own with no vegetation, or do you try to save that animal? And once you have healed the paws of a koala bear, you know, with mittens, do you then bring them back into the environment?
Once again, it's a case-by-case basis, and when we have a call to respond to an animal, we'll send out one or two teams. We'll assess that animal's needs. Sometimes we do sedate them in field and bring them back to our triage centre. Sometimes they're okay to leave as a watch and act action, and we monitor those over several days. And sometimes if there's enough feed around, we can leave them there. So we certainly don't leave them to fend for themselves. We make sure that all their needs are met as far as safety, vegetation, food, water, and any injuries that need to be monitored.
Dr. Rachel Westcott, a veterinarian with South Australian Veterinary Emergency Management, or SAVEM, on rescuing animal victims of bushfires. Dr. Westcott, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Delighted to talk with you.
Boy, it really gives me such hope for humanity, really, that there are people that do that.
And make mittens for koalas.
Introducing the new four-course Festa Italiana starting at $13.99 from Olive Garden.
What could be better than Golden Corral's piping hot and delicious yeast rolls? How about six free yeast rolls to take home?
The Yumbo Hot Ham and Cheese from the 70s is back.
Yumbo.
Hot black forest ham and melted cheese. And it's on the Burger King 2 for $5 menu.
Are you hungry now? Maybe in the mood for a burger? That is a question Brian Wansink has been looking into. Do food ads work? Wansink is director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University and author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. He's with us from Chicago. Brian, welcome.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Well, we see these food ads everywhere all the time, on TV, on billboards, online, even on social media these days. How effective are they in getting us to eat the foods that are being advertised?
Well, they're really effective in getting us to eat the foods they advertise if we eat in that category to begin with. So if we see, for instance, a fast food ad, it can be very effective in getting somebody who already eats fast food to go to place X instead of to eat chicken or whatever else they'd eat. But they're not quite as effective at getting somebody who wasn't really interested in the category to begin with to jump in.
Why not?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people have lines that they draw about what they do and what they don't do. So, for instance, there's 2/3 of the population of adults don't smoke, and about 2/3 don't drink any more than one drink a year. Yet these people see tons of smoking ads. They see tons of liquor ads. It's like you almost screen it out if it's not something that is part of your typical routine.
So they know that they're advertising just to people who are likely to eat at the restaurant.
Yeah, that's where a lot of the action happens. And you know, it's interesting when you see these really crazy new product introductions, like the the double down burger, or the the four burger Burger King hamburger. Even in most of these cases, they don't really expect to sell a lot of these four patty burgers. But what that does is it gives kind of cool news to that chain or to that restaurant that makes people say, geez, I wasn't even thinking of that place. Hey, let's go there.
Well, let's pretend like they're marketing to somebody who is likely to go to that restaurant. Do these ads make us overeat? Do they make us eat more than we otherwise would?
If it's a type of advertising that sort of implies a something healthy or a health claim, like not now, try our light McLean sandwich, whatever the case is, we know in those cases that anything that suggests healthfulness does cause us to over-order side items.
I'm thinking of that episode of Seinfeld where they all think they're eating fat-free frozen yogurt, but in fact, it turns out it's not fat-free. So you're saying if they make us think that it's the healthy option, we are more likely to overeat.
Yeah, and for two reasons. First of all, when we think of something as being low fat, we assume it's lower in calories. It's really, in most cases, only about 11% lower in calories because they do take fat out, but they replace it with sugar. And so the problem ends up being is we overeat it because we think it has fewer calories than it actually has. But second of all, we also overeat it because we end up wanting to reward ourselves for being a good boy or a good girl by ordering the right choice. And in general, if somebody eats a low-fat item, they eat between 40 and 44% more calories than if they just would have eaten the regular version.
So does food advertising need to be regulated further?
Food advertising, if it's used well, can actually turn the tide in a lot of the poor choices that are being made. Now, I'll give you kind of an example. We do a lot of work in the school lunchrooms with something called the Smarter Lunchroom Movement. And there's been a lot of talk that says, hey, we shouldn't have any brands in schools. It's evil. It's evil, I tell you.
Yeah.
And one of the things we did was we said, well, let's take a look at branding. We took cookies and we took carrots. And if we put this little Elmo sticker on a cookie, it doesn't increase the sales of wrapped cookies at all because people like cookies to begin with. And, 80% of the kids will take it. And if you put a sticker on, 81% take it. No real increase. But you put that sticker on a bag of carrots and it triples in the amount of kids who take carrots and eat it.
Would that work for adults, that the food labeling will actually make a difference in how much we like the food that we're eating?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we've done – what happens is our taste is tremendously subjective. You know this when you're actually out to dinner with a friend and they say, hey, taste this appetizer. Does this taste a little salty to you? You'll taste it looking for the salt. But we also know it when a waiter or waitress says, hey, we have our Tuscan fire-roasted – red peppers, you kind of go, oh, man, that is going to be great. And we find simply adding a descriptive word to foods end up making people about 27% more likely to take them, but it also increases their taste ratings after they've finished.
Hmm. So what can consumers do then to not be so influenced by the labeling, to actually be making choices based on what's good for them, what they like, rather than being hypnotized into buying something that, or eating something or enjoying something that they don't really want?
Well, one thing you can do is if you are trying to estimate whether something's healthy or how many calories are in it, you can take your best guess as to how many calories you think is in it. If you double that estimate, you're going to be a lot closer to the reality. Okay. What you can also end up doing is in a lot of these cases with restaurant foods, it's hard to tell what's going to be healthy in a restaurant, but here's the key. If you go to a waitress or waiter in a restaurant and you say, look, tell me the two or three items on your menu that are the lightest and most popular, what you'll do is she or he will point out a couple of things that you would have never thought of that are actually really good and will keep you from being tricked by sort of words. But what you can't ask is, can you tell me two or three of your healthiest items? Because all he or she is going to do is point at the salads, and you're not going to get that really great ham that might have been prepared in a way that's really lower in fat than you would have otherwise guessed.
Well, and frankly, at some restaurants where you can see the calorie counts on these things, the salads have just as much as the burger and fries. But we'll leave that for another day. You published another book this September, Slim by Design, Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life. And the premise is that instead of telling people what they should and should not be eating, we should instead be thinking about tailoring our environment so that we're naturally inclined to eat healthier. How does that work?
Well, there's really small ways that we can do this. I mean, we find, for instance, that even if you have a cluttered kitchen, you're going to eat 44% more snacks than somebody who has a clear, clean kitchen. So there's a lot of these changes that people can make. If actually, in for each of these five environments, whether it be our home or restaurants, where we shop, where we work, and where kids go to school, we have 100-point scorecards that show you whether your home is making you fat by design or slim by design. And it's a whole lot easier to simply serve your pasta off the stove or off the counter and eat 30% less than it is to have it right in front of you where you're going to eat seconds and thirds and fourths. And that's why we say it's a lot easier to become slim by design than slim by willpower.
So don't bring that food over to the table. Leave it on the stove?
Yeah. And it tremendously benefits men more than women because men tend to have that tendency towards seconds and thirds to a greater extent than women do.
How do we get our coworker, who is a wonderful baker, to stop making brownies for everybody's birthdays that we then need to eat?
That's right. Oh, that is wonderful. You know, one of the things that we end up doing in my lab is we have fruit bowls all over the place, and at some point when there's fruit bowls that are full of stuff, you know, bringing in a big platter of cookies for somebody's birthday is kind of the equivalent of bringing a bong into a boardroom. People just let you stretch.
Well, you know, in Colorado, maybe that's what they do. Brian Wansink, director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab and the author of Slim by Design, Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was great to be with you. Thank you.
And if you've got solutions to make yourself or others eat less, let us know. Do food ads work for you? You can go to our website, hereandnow.org.
And we're not going to mention her name, but it sounds like Emiko. Emiko, stop with the brownies.
We love the brownies, no, Emiko, but boy, we got a big staff now. It's always somebody's birthday. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service and the Brownie Corporation of America. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.